Welcome to this week's installment of Cultural Conversations. You can leave questions and comments at our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturalconversations.
So Pitocin is a medical, it's a chemical version of our body's own natural oxytocin, which is a hormone. It's called the love hormone. And its whole purpose is to create bonds between human beings. So when I hug you, we're releasing a little tiny bit of oxytocin, and it makes us feel connected. When we make love, we release a lot of oxytocin. When we hold babies, any baby, but especially our own baby, massive amounts of oxytocin are being pumped. And those hormone releases are the keystone for bonding, that early bonding that is absolutely crucial for the mother's recovery from birth and the baby's first few days of life. If that doesn't happen, some of those very basic keystones don't get placed, and it's very hard to replace them later. Mm-hmm. There is no study that I can point to, but again, tons of anecdotal evidence, tons of discussion among midwives and lactation consultants and people, doulas, people that spend a lot of time with birthing women, tons of discussion about Pitocin and how it overrides our body's own natural oxytocin and why there's a rise in attachment disorders. Well, at the same time that there's a rise in Pitocin use.
Now, I think I can imagine what your response to this question is going to be, but how do you feel about when you hear a mother saying, I want to schedule my birth for this day and the doctor administers Pitocin? Mm-hmm. It's because they have other things coming up and they mm-hmm. want to be able to make those events. You know, mm-hmm. their calendar is full mm-hmm. and they want to arrange their delivery on a certain date. How do you feel about that?
Well, there's a huge difference between how I respond to that woman and the internal dialogue. How I respond to that woman is to start asking questions. And inside, my dialogue might be going, oh my gosh, this woman's been railroaded, or she doesn't know all of her options, or she hasn't done her homework. That's my internal dialogue. My external dialogue is much more compassionate than that, I hope. I try. And I try to create just a tiny little space for her to start to think about whether that really is the best plan for her and her baby. Not preaching, but asking questions. Well, why is that the best plan? Have you had some issues with your pregnancy? Are there things that have happened that have made you think that this needs to be done this way? So those little questions can sometimes open doors. I've seen women change their birth plans very late in their pregnancies. I've seen them change care providers very late in their pregnancy to be with someone who was more in line with what their goals were. So we talk about the McDonald's effect. I have women come in and they are saying that they want to have a natural birth and they want to have the baby up on their chest right away after the birth, or they want to have a water birth, or they've done their research and they have found that having a doula will really help them shorten their labors and they'll have less chance of problems and will need less drugs and all of those things. But they're with a care provider. When I say, who's your care provider? And they tell me, and they say, well, you can do it with that person, but it's sort of like walking into McDonald's and ordering the sushi platter. You know, maybe you'll get it, but would you really want it? And it would be a lot easier and probably better to walk into a good sushi restaurant and order your sushi platter. So finding the care provider, spending a little time finding the care provider that will help you achieve the birth that you have in your mind, crucial.
Now, when, can you recall, like when you have a complication with a patient, where do you draw the line as far as, okay, mm-hmm. she needs to be under physician consultation at this point? Because I know that's a question I've heard, thrown about in the past is, well, how do they know when? When is that line drawn and, okay, now I need to move her somewhere else?
Right. And when it's self-regulated, that line is different for different midwives, right? In states where it's legally mandated, it's very clear. This woman has had high blood pressure the last two visits. She will be changing care providers. She's no longer low risk. Any midwife will tell you that I only work with low risk women, right? But what is considered low risk might be different for different midwives.
It's relative.
It is a little relative. In this country, because each state has its own guidelines or no guidelines at all. So I would say that the vast majority of midwives that have had any training at all for out-of-institution birth have been trained very, very carefully, and that is the largest part of the training, is to know when things are not within the range of normal.
So a breech birth?
Not within the range of normal. No. In almost all states that are regulated, and for the large majority of midwives who practice out of institution, they just don't have the experience. It's not that I think that breech is necessarily, I think that it is a variation of normal. But most of us don't have any training and certainly don't have much experience. So for most midwives, that is not something that they'll take on. There are a few people that do have the training and do have the experience. And honestly, that is now becoming more of an acceptable variation of normal because women don't want to go have a C-section for a breech baby. Most midwives have a lot of tricks up their sleeves to help the baby not be breech, you know?
I remember my OBGYN told me my daughter was breech, so we had to do an emergency C-section, and I was not prepared for that whatsoever. Right. And he was from South Africa originally, and he told me, you know, if I was in South Africa, I've delivered hundreds of babies breech.
Yes.
He's like, in the United States, it's too much of a liability. He goes, I will not do it.
Right.
And I just found that fascinating. I was very grateful for his honesty, but I also felt like, but I'm going to get opened up. This is a surgery.
And that's frustrating to me when I think about care providers as a whole. There should be, in my opinion, care providers who are trained and prepared to do that and whose insurance will cover that liability, because the statistics are clear that a breech birth vaginally is actually less of a risk to mother and baby than a cesarean.
In what ways?
You have risk of infection.
Infection, okay.
Huge risk of infection. You have a much higher chance of postpartum depression. Right? You have, but it has to be someone who's trained. See, and he was, and he still didn't want to go there because the system that he's working in isn't supportive of even, they're not even supportive of what he's trained to do. And I hear that a lot from doctors. I have a huge amount of sympathy for the doctors in this country. They are dealing with massive amounts of pressure from, they have many bosses that they have to answer to. They have to answer to the other care providers in their practice. They have to answer to their insurance companies.
Drug companies.
They have to answer to, yeah, it's just, the list is long. They have to answer to the institution that they work in. And that's a big one. There are times when a doctor's like, I have no problem with you eating during labor, but the hospital won't allow it.
So, and that makes me think of what you had mentioned earlier as far as, you know, $3,000 to hire a midwife, and then the average, Western trained physician guided pregnancy and childbirth experience being $5,000. So, you know, there's a substantial savings there. Can you speak more about the medicalization from a money perspective, the inflation of hospitalization and things like that? Then the reason I'm asking this is because a family member, she was having an ultrasound done every week for the last few months of her pregnancy. Every week.
For what reason?
I don't know, other than the doctor said that they wanted to see how the baby was doing. I'm not exactly sure she got a reason why and just deferred to their expertise. Right. They know what they're talking about. I'm not a physician. I've been scratching my head ever since because, do we know the long-term effects of repeated ultrasounds? And I figured the answer was she's shaking her head no. But I'm just thinking the cost involved.
Yes.
Not to mention the exposure to the mother and to the baby.
Yes. No, there's not a long-term study on ultrasound. There are studies from the late 80s, early 90s, and they were inconclusive. They said that it was probably clear that non-serial ultrasound didn't cause lasting defects. However, there's not one study that's been done since the amount of ultrasound, the megahertz level has gone up by, I don't even remember the statistic, it's a humongous amount. So the amount of megahertz that are traveling through even a handheld Doppler now, I believe, are over 6 times more powerful than they were when those studies were done. And there has not been one study done.
That's incredible.
And we're not just doing a handheld Doppler where you're just putting it on for a minute or so and listening through one contraction. We're using ultrasound to do 4D, you know, the lifelike keepsake pictures, which is a massive amount that we're exposing our babies to with no studies done. There's serial ultrasounds like you're describing. And then there's many hospitals and also some care providers who, or situations, it's very specific to each situation, where you're doing constant, continuous fetal monitoring from the moment the woman goes into labor until the baby comes out. So hours, hours and hours and hours of continuous fetal monitoring. No studies. So that's a concern for me when I'm seeing more and more. My father's a psychologist, so I'm a little aware of the trending that goes through his office and the rise in ADHD, attention disorders, the rise in autism. You know, when I read a study that says that 1 in 4 kids in Salt Lake City is now diagnosed with autism, I wonder why, you know?
It does. That sounds like that could be another discussion in and of itself, and many more to come. Why? I know there's a lot of focus on autism right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and what you're talking about, the long-term, we don't know the long-term health effects from all the, you know, Pitocin or serial ultrasounds or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of cost there. You know, I can't even imagine what one ultrasound costs. Now, granted, if it's covered by insurance, great. Right. But if you don't have insurance in this country and you have a high-risk pregnancy, right, and need to have, right, that monitoring more, I can't imagine how much that accrues.
I don't know through a medical provider what it would be. I know that there's a storefront in Columbus where you can just walk in and get an ultrasound. And the non-4D, just the regular ultrasound, so you can go in and check out your baby, is, I believe, $350 to $500.
It's like a McDonald's for ultrasounds, mm-hmm, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and I think that part of the growth for that industry, because that's not the only place in the country like that, is what you're talking about, people that don't have, you know, solid prenatal care in place because of financial issues.
Now, speaking of Ohio, as a nationally certified professional midwife living here in a state where it is not openly endorsed, how do you practice?
I don't. I have chosen not to. I have young children, and there have been midwives in this state who have been arrested and fined and threatened with jail time, and I cannot. My risk tolerance is too low for that. I'm choosing not to practice right now, which makes me sad.
Who's most threatened by that? You know, they're fined, they're arrested, or whatever the case may be. Who do you think is most fearful? Where's this backlash coming from?
I have seen it mostly from the OMA, from the Ohio Medical Association.
So Western-trained physicians.
Yes. Well, I don't think as individuals so much, honestly. I see less. Well, that's not true. I would say that once a physician gets to know me, the fear starts to dissipate because they see that I'm not wacky. They see that I would be practicing appropriately, that I do know what I'm talking about, and that I know how to differentiate between high risk and low risk. But they don't know that for every midwife. And it is, I'm getting off track here. Where's the fear? Why is the attack happen? The midwives that have been arrested by attorney generals for the county that they live in almost every time. Mm-hmm. And the assumption is that they are putting the public health at jeopardy. And in some cases, that may be true. They may be poorly trained. They may be calling themselves midwives with no training whatsoever, which they can do in this state. In one particular case in Cincinnati, she was a certified professional midwife with years of experience and transported appropriately by most people's estimation to a hospital where she was met with a great deal of hostility. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but the bottom line is that she had her home raided and everything was taken that could have had anything to do with her practice, and she was brought to trial and charged with a lot of counts of practicing medicine and nursing without a license, and told that she needed to cease and that she was no longer going to be working in this state and that it was illegal in this state. And she ended up moving to Canada and going back to school so that she could meet the Canadian requirements. And she's a midwife there now. So Ohio lost a good care provider, an appropriate care provider. That's lost revenue for the state. It's a loss for the women of this state to have another option for how they want to birth. It was a seamless, she was lucky enough to have developed a relationship with an excellent obstetrician, an OB in Cincinnati area, and they had a great working partnership where she would handle a lot of the low-risk cases that wanted to have an out-of-institution birth, and he was there to manage the case if something happened prenatally that needed more attention, or, you know, they got risked out of a home birth, or if during labor they needed to transport, he was there to accept them. And
so did he support her? Did the OB support her?
He did. Unfortunately, this woman was not one of his patients. This was someone who had a different care provider.
Okay.
And that's why it happened the way that it did. If she had transported into the care provider that this midwife worked with, it would not have happened that way.
Now, a friend of mine who by training is a jack of many trades. She's a nurse. She's a medical anthropologist.
Oh, cool.
And she's a licensed midwife. She's delivered hundreds, if not thousands, of babies. And when she was living in Florida, she opened up the first birthing center in the Tampa area. And the physician backlash, it still puts a bad taste in her mouth. It was just horrific. She had never seen such animosity geared toward women like yourself who are trained in how to give to support, trained to know when this is high risk and I need to, you know, refer this woman on or whatever the case may be. She couldn't believe, but she was successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine how difficult that was for her. Now, explain to me and to the listeners, what are you doing to change what's going on in Ohio right now?
Well, we've been working really hard to educate people about all of their options and to realize that this is not us trying to stand up and take business away from obstetricians. It's us trying to stand up and say, this is not a system that's working for the women of Ohio. This is a system that is very lopsided. And when women want to go find another option, they have to know that nod and a handshake, and they have to do their own due diligence and make sure that the care provider that they are choosing actually is trained and actually does carry appropriate things and is willing to take the risk to provide the care for them, including if they transport to go with them and not leave them at the doorstep. That's a lot of the reason, honestly, that doctors have a bad taste in their mouths about home birth midwives is that midwives are scared because they're not part of the system.
They're not protected.
They're not in any way, shape, or form part of the system with any of the benefits that come from that, or the downsides either, but certainly none of the benefits. So they get scared in a bad situation and they do not act appropriately. They do not transport in with their client. They do not have medical records that they can hand over with their client so that the story is there and seamless for the new care provider. So it's called a dump and run, and they leave these nightmare cases on the doorstep at the hospital and run.
Hmm.
And people get very vitriolic towards the midwife. I get vitriolic towards the system. And I say the system's broken, or these women would not be acting like this. They would be acting appropriately.
Do you have legislative support in the state of Ohio?
Well, we had a really active movement going about 6 months ago, and it has started to peter out, and I'm very upset about it. We had a great lobbyist who was working with us who really believed in the case, in our cause, and he was working very, very well with both sides of the aisle, and both with the Senate and the House, and due to finances and our inability to raise funds and keep our lobbyist paid the minimal amount that he was asking for, we're not working with him anymore.
So are things in a holding pattern then?
Things are in a holding pattern.
Okay.
There's a great deal of dissent within the midwives in this state, and a lot of midwives are anti-legislature. They do not want to be legislated. They like it the way it is now.
Hmm.
Yes, I know it's really, it's an interesting phenomenon from an anthropological viewpoint.
Yes, it is.
Very interesting. But there is not a united front among the midwives of Ohio. There are definitely two strong factions, and one is pro-license, pro-legislation, and one is very anti. And the reasons for that are that they don't want to be told what they can and cannot do. And they do not, they feel that it limits choices for women, because many of the states that regulate midwifery have put into place strictures stating what constitutes low risk. And that usually includes breaches. It usually includes VBACs or vaginal birth after cesarean. So once you've had a cesarean, doing a vaginal delivery at home would be considered unsafe in a majority of the regulated states. And that's the big one, because there are so many women who have had cesarean sections and then want to find a different option the next time around. You know, sure. That opens up their minds to the fact that there must be a different way to do this.
You know, this is something that's been practiced for hundreds, if not thousands of years, mm-hmm. and is still the preferred in Europe. Aren't there the majority of births are done via...
In many countries, yeah. So in England, 75% of births are with some type of midwife, either in hospital or out. The Netherlands, again, the gold standard worldwide. In the Netherlands, 30% of births are home births. Considered as... Why would you have an obstetrician attend a normal, boring, long labor? That would be a waste of resources. Total waste of resources. Why would we spend that money? Why would he or she spend their time that way?
Right.
Have a midwife do it. As soon as it becomes not normal out of the midwife's scope of practice, it gets kicked up the ladder. And it's the midwife. You start with a midwife in the Netherlands. You start with the lowest level of the care providers, right? And you get kicked up as you get risked out more and more and more. And that's not the system we have here. We start somewhere up around Q in the alphabet instead of an A.
That comes with a hefty price.
It does, because honestly, if you're a Q, everything you look at is a Q, right? And again, I don't blame the healthcare providers. They are practicing as appropriately as they know how, and they're trained to practice in a certain way. So if you see a nail and you've been trained with a hammer, everything needs to be hit with your hammer.
Sure.
You know, and even if it maybe is a screw, you've got the hammer.
Have you been able to practice or observe midwives in other countries? Have you been able to get more of a cross-cultural perspective on midwifery?
I have friendships with midwives from other cultures. I have friends who are midwives who have gone overseas and studied or have practiced or have done mission work or whatever. And I have a good friend who's in Benin, Africa, as a midwife, and she is from there, born and raised there, and she's a midwife there. And it's considered the norm. They look at us like we're crazy.
I was just going to say, they're probably scratching their heads like, this is the United States, and what is going on here?
They think we're crazy. I have had women move here from other states where it's legal, like Washington State, and they don't get it. It makes no sense to them. It takes them a few months of hearing it over and over to wrap their heads around it.
Is the medical establishment in the Cleveland area more open to this, or are they even more closed?
Okay. I would say the northern part of the state is less open. Cincinnati, the corridor between Columbus and Cincinnati, which includes Dayton, I would say is more open-minded and interested in this particular type of birthing option. It's odd. There is actually in Columbus Choice Midwives, which is a group of, at this point, I think there's about 13 midwives that work there. And they have a couple of apprentices that are training, and they are right out there. They're in the yellow pages. Everyone knows that they're there. They only do out-of-institution home births. They rent water, pools for giving birth in. They do prenatals at their offices.
They're not worried about any legal repercussions?
I guess they are, and they don't care. They've been there for years.
But even in the yellow pages.
Choice was actually started by the very first certified professional midwife. The first one in the entire country, Abby Kinney. And she just recently died. But Choice is going on without her. And they've been there forever, and they just keep practicing. I don't know how they do it. None of the other midwives in the state understand how they do it.
Now, haven't you started a network yourself?
Yes,
can Dar you Alouz describe Network. What that's?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the organization that I co-founded is called Dar Alouz Network, which is the Spanish phrase for to give birth. The literal translation is to bring to the light, which I thought was a beautiful, double meaning there. So our mission is to provide support and information unconditionally. So you tell me you're having a planned C-section next Tuesday, I will support you. And I will help you in whatever way that I can. And if you ask me for information, I'll give it to you and help you figure out what you want to do with that information. If you tell me that you want to have a baby out in a field by yourself with your husband, I will support you and I will give you whatever information you need to have the birth that you want. My experience is that women are hungry for support, that women do best giving birth and parenting when they are supported without condition.
Well, that's when we're most vulnerable.
It is the most, and we need the support, labile state that we will ever be in as human beings, as women. And everything that we read, everything that is said to us, everything that we intuit by watching how someone reacts to what we say, we are so open and receptive during our pregnancies and births and that early postpartum time. It's an honor and a huge responsibility to spend time with women in that state, because everything that you do and say affects everything way more than at any other time in their life.
If you could leave listeners with one final message about the world's second oldest profession, what would that be?
So one is to do your homework. Don't just assume that what you're being offered is your best choice for you. There's a phrase, if you don't know your choices, you don't have any. And I subscribe to that wholeheartedly. Do your homework. Spend as much time researching who your care provider is and what their practice is as you do what kind of car seat you're going to get. It's money well spent mm-hmm. to spend that time. My other one is another phrase that I can't attribute to the person that said it, but I love it. And she says, there's a secret that has to do with childbirth. And it's not that birth is painful. It's that women are strong.
That's a far more powerful message than what we're told from childhood on.
Yes.
It's something to fear.
Yes.
Instead of, you're powerful. Thank you for speaking with me today, April. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Thank you for listening to Cultural Conversations, edited by Sarah D'Elia and Blake Lau. Join me every Thursday for a new installment of the podcast at nipr.fm to learn more about this beautiful human mosaic. You can leave questions and comments at our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturalconversations.